Mark chapter 5. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, and immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. And he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles to pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. Crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For when he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send him out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And so he begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs. Let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs and the herd, numbering about 2,000. They rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. Verse 14, the herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. Then they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion sitting there, clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described it to them, what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. They began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with them. And he did not permit him, but he said to him, "Go home to your friends, tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Arthur, I'm getting a little bit of an echo. Is the other channel muted? All right, so Jesus crosses the sea in verse 1. If you remember from the end of chapter 4, I know it was 2 weeks ago, but Jesus gets in a boat at night with his disciples, and they start crossing from west to east, okay? They cross from Capernaum, which is Jesus' hometown. This is where him and his disciples live, and they go east. They're going east towards the Jordan River out of what would be Israel, okay? They're heading to the other side of the lake. Remember, at nighttime, a storm comes up. The disciples kind of freak out. They're afraid. These are half of them anyway, fishermen, people that are used to being in a boat on the water, used to storms and such. Apparently, this storm was strong enough that it scared them. Water's coming into the boat. They panic. In the meantime, Jesus is sleeping. He's in this boat. Now, this is not a cruise ship. You know, this is not a yacht. This is not even a pontoon. Okay, this is just a rowboat. they're just rowing or sailing in probably not that large of a vessel. They wake Jesus up. They say, "Aren't you afraid that we're going to drown?" Jesus gets up. He yells at the weather. He just says, "Stop it." And it does. It listens. The storm calms down. The sea goes flat and peaceful. At Jesus' command, the weather listens to him, and it calms itself down. But that's not the end of the story. Then Jesus turns to his disciples and kind of gets in their faces a little bit, doesn't he? He rebukes the wind. Then he rebukes his disciples. He says, "How long have you been with me? Don't you believe in the things that I'm doing? Don't you believe in the one that you're with?" And they're all even more scared. This guy's got power over the weather. Okay, he could make some really terrible things happen. Well, they're still on that journey when they are crossing here at the beginning of our chapter. They cross to the other side. Okay, so verse 1, they came to the other side of the sea. And it says, to the country of the Gerasenes. Okay, now, some of your Bibles are going to say the Gadarenes. This is a land that's actually outside of what was the country of Israel. Remember, Jesus did not live in the nation of Israel. He was Jewish. He was an Israelite by nationality. The country of Israel did not exist while he was alive. I mean, it did, but it didn't. They had been captured by the Babylonians, 600, 700, 800 BC. They never were restored to a nation until about the 1900s. So they spent 2,500 years not being an official nation. They had their own boundaries. The Roman Empire had now taken over and ruled over a vast section of the land. So when we say that he went to the Gerasenes, it gives us a reference point of where he was in what was Israel and what is today Israel. But back then, Israel wasn't a recognized country. This actually has significance to the story, and we'll get into it in a minute, but he's exiting what was the promised land, the nation of Israel, given by God to the Israelites, but he's going to a place that's on the fringe. Okay, in the Old Testament, the book of Joshua, the people enter into the promised land. Remember, God rescues them out of Egypt. They wander around in the desert for 40 years. And then when they go and enter into the promised land, a couple of the tribes, there's 12 tribes that made up this entire nation, they decided they didn't want to go in. They liked it better on the outside. They saw some land as they were going in, and they said, we want to live here. Okay, this is the tribe of Gad. That's why it's called the Gadarenes. They're going to the area where these people basically refused to enter into God's full blessing and said, we're going to stay outside on the fringe. We'll worship God, but we're not going to obey him fully. This is the people Jesus is going to. Now, this is carried down through the centuries beyond. But this is the people Jesus is going to. We'll get back to this idea because it is important to the story. Think of it this way. This is like your parents buy a new home. You're a little kid. You've got nothing to offer the equation, but you, on moving day, you enter into the house and you're wowed by the huge cathedral ceilings in the living room. You see a cool couple of rooms on the way in and you say, I want that one. That one's mine. And your parents are saying, no, your room's upstairs. It's in the bell tower. There's a turret and a surround window. You get your own private room up there. And you're like, no, I'm gonna stick with this one because I saw it and it's mine. You're selling yourself short. That's what these people did. So Jesus arrives on shore. Okay, his ministry takes him to these varying remote areas. And again, he's out on the fringe of people that they would have identified with God, but they weren't necessarily obeying him. Okay, so he steps off the boat. First thing that happens, a demon-possessed man runs up to him. Okay, this is a crazy man. It says he lived in a cemetery. He spent all his time wandering the mountains, screaming, yelling, and cutting himself. He said there wasn't anybody that was strong enough to keep him under control. They tried tying him up. They tried putting chains and shackles on him. He just broke free. Okay, this is like the green guy in the comic series. He's mad and he breaks stuff. Just blind rage. This guy's a senseless and irrational person. Okay, strong physically, but also out of his mind. Insane, okay? The man runs up to Jesus. He bows down to him. He's not meant to worship him. He's not honoring him. This is not him giving worship to Jesus as God, but he does recognize that Jesus is special. He recognizes that Jesus is God's son. He even says so. Okay, even demons bow down before God knowing that he has the full authority over their existence. This man, he's not the one in control. It's the demons inside of him. But they run up to Jesus. They bow down and say, don't do what you're going to do. They're afraid. Or at least they're trying to avoid being taken out of the man. Well, Jesus tells them, you're going to have to leave that guy. So they make a request. They say, can we go into these pigs? Okay, this is weird, isn't it? Can we go into that herd of pigs over there? And for whatever reason, Jesus says yes. Okay, so they do. The demons leave him. And by the way, it's not just one demon. They say there are many of them. They say legion. Legion's a term for a large segment of an army. We don't really know how many there are, but a lot. Okay, more than one and a lot. They go over to the pigs. They enter the pigs, and they start this stampede. Okay, they're on this periphery of this big lake. It's called the Sea of Galilee. You can call it lake or sea, whatever you want to call it. Anyway, wherever they are, pigs stampede off a cliff down into the lake, and they all die. And there's 2,000 of them. Imagine the spectacle this would have been. Has anyone ever seen a huge hog farm? You know, just tons and tons of... I don't know what 2,000 pigs look like, more than I can imagine, I think. But even worse than that, if I saw that many pigs rushing off the edge of a cliff, dying and splattering down below. We're going down to Louisiana a few years ago on a trip. We're all driving in our campers. We're driving down the highway. It's, you know, we're just happy to be leaving home and going south. Along the way, there's a semi in the ditch that's tipped over. There was cattle in there. There's cows in the semi trailer. They hadn't done anything to clean it up yet. It fell over into the ditch. There's just this mass and wreck of carcasses, cattle carcasses, okay, dead cows piled on the side of the road. Now, I didn't actually see it, and so I'm trusting my imagination on this one, but from the report that I got, it was shocking. We had 20 hours to drive and think about that. That's basically what we had. Imagine 2,000 pigs going over the edge of a cliff, okay? What does it say happened next? The people come rushing out to see what's going on. Of course they did. Of course the people were like, what in the world is going on? They probably heard the stampede, felt the stampede, or in some way had somebody that knew, you know, something about it. So they come out, they want to see what's going on. Okay? The people that were the herdsmen over those pigs, they scatter, they run away. The man himself was crazy, was just, you know, rebellious, was a wild card. He's now calm. He's sitting with Jesus. He's now dressed. He's wearing clothes. Okay, this is quite the change in him. His demeanor has changed. He's now in his right mind, is what it says. And it says the people that come out to see what's going on, they beg Jesus to leave. They ask him to go. Okay, they don't like what happens. Maybe that's understandable. But they beg him to leave. Okay, so he goes to leave. And the guy who was demon-possessed, he's now sane. He's now in his right mind. He's now calm. He begs Jesus to go along with him. He says, I want to come with you. Okay, Jesus tells him no. He says, you stay here, and you just tell everybody else the great thing that God has done for you. And it says the guy responds to that. He does. Okay, he says, go and tell your friends all that God has done for you. The man starts going around in the area, and it says everybody's amazed to see who he is now and to hear his story. And that's where we stopped. So this is a pretty out there story. I mean, there's a lot of things happening here, sensational stuff. What can we learn from it? Or what should we take away from it? I want to start with something that's, I think, probably on all your minds. Okay, I'm going to start with what I believe probably your greatest interest and need is here and now. Why the pigs? I know that's what you're thinking. What's the story? Why the pigs? Okay. This actually goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Remember, this is the group, the tribe of Israel that did not enter the promised land but stayed out on the fringe. Okay, these are people that they're Jewish by heritage. They were going to worship God, and yet they chose to disobey God. That disobedience did not just prevent them from entering the promised land. It also led them to live a life that was disobedient to what God would have for them. Jewish people can't eat pork. It's against the religious law for Jewish people to eat bacon, okay, to eat ham, to eat any pork product. Pigs are an unclean animal for them. These people are Jewish and worshiping God, and yet they're not obeying God in how they're living. They're raising pigs. What could you do with pigs back then besides eat them? I guess you could be a manure farmer. That's possible. I guess nowadays pigs contribute to all sorts of different things. Antifreeze, they're part of the process for creating antifreeze. Anybody heard this before? Okay, thank you, Maria. Because I read it today and I was like, this is, I don't know. Thank you. You could do oil, you could do skin, and so on. But really, back then, what was the primary purpose and cause? It was going to be food. And so these people were disobedient. These people were disobedient to God. So many would say that when Jesus was curing the demon-possessed man of his possession, he was freeing the man of his possession, he was simultaneously judging and fixing the disobedience of these people. He was wrecking their industry. He was wrecking their disobedience. He was taking away the entire opportunity they had to continue disobeying God. So he's simultaneously freeing the man who was possessed and addressing the sin of the people at the same time. Okay, now for us, just think about this. Think about it from the perspective of the people of Gad, the Gadarenes, people that were raising the pigs. Are you settled right now on the edge of God's blessing? For you personally, are you settled on the fringe? Sort of half in, half out. You understand that God wants you in to where he's asking, and yet you've found a place that you're comfortable with, that you like, that you prefer, and you've settled there and said, this is as far as I'm going to go. Are you settled on the edge of God's blessing? Another way to say it, are you worshiping God but not obeying? Worshiping being church and Bible reading and praying, talking about God when the opportunity comes, but yet the actual lived out action of your life, the activity of your life, it's not obedience. You do what you want, and then you try and worship God on top of that. That's kind of what we're looking at here. Is that you? Another way to look at it, is there something unclean in your life that Jesus just might come along and destroy the next opportunity he gets? And by the way, I believe God does this. God is an active player in our universe. He's not removed. He's not far away. He's not just letting things play out until the end. He actively steps into our realities, our lives, and he does stuff. Sometimes he wrecks stuff. I believe Jesus would do that. If it was something that was preventing you from living out life with God the way he would ask you to, he might step in and do something about it. He might not, but he might so. I believe God does this to us. That's what these people were totally afraid of. That's exactly what they were afraid of, and we'll come back to that in a moment. Let's look at the man's response. Okay, this is the demon-possessed man. He's been completely changed from totally crazy to totally normal. Okay, from angry to joyful. From possessed to free. And in response, he begs Jesus to go along with them. He is over-eager to be with Jesus as close as he can be. Travel on. Join his traveling party. And then Jesus tells him no. He says, no, you need to stay here. You need to tell everybody you know what God has done for you. Okay? The man goes and does this very ambitiously. It says he did this in the Decapolis. Okay, anybody have any idea? This is rhetorical, by the way. Any idea what the Decapolis is? It means 10 cities. The word Decapolis means 10 cities. If you look at a map from the time period back then, you'll see it's just this sort of non-distinct blob in the map. They don't really know what the 10 cities were. They don't really know. The man doesn't just go back to his village. He doesn't just go back to his family. He doesn't just go back to his, you know, friends. He starts traveling around and telling everybody on that side. Because Jesus is going to get in the boat and go back the other way. The man is now the missionary out here for Jesus. He's now the minister. He's now the one proclaiming the good thing that Jesus did for him. The way he does this, not just the ambition, okay, take that out for just a second, but the way he does this, this is super important and super helpful for all of us. Okay? Jesus tells him how to do it, and the man does it. And the way that he does it is really, really helpful and really, really important for us. As Christians, we're supposed to be witnesses to what God has done in our lives. We're supposed to be witnesses for Jesus here, stretch that out into our region, stretch that out into our nation, and into the entire world. We're supposed to be witnesses for Jesus of God's grace and mercy. And Jesus tells them, just simply share what God has done for you. This is really important. Don't miss this. A lot of us get this wrong. We make it about sharing the knowledge of God. We make it about sharing facts about God, doctrine about God. Jesus is saying, just tell others what God has done for you. He's not saying, tell them, you know, the Ten Commandments. Tell them the argument against, you know, the Big Bang Theory. He's not saying, tell them the arguments against this religion or that religion. You don't have to debunk anything. You don't have to know certain things. You don't have to be super smart. You don't have to be super worked out in your logic and reasoning and philosophy. That stuff can be helpful, but that's not how you're a witness. That stuff most of the time gets in the way. For most of us in this room, that stuff gets in the way because we set this parameter that says, I'll be ready to share my faith when I know enough. Once I know enough facts and have enough confidence in what I know, then I'll be able to share my faith with the people I know. That's a barrier for most of us in this room. This man didn't have any of those things. You know what he had? He has a new and clear perspective on life. God changed him, and he's excited about that. He's thankful. He has gratitude towards Jesus. And thirdly, he's got a really good story to tell. Okay. Now, we could embellish ours and try and match what this guy had. Or you could trust that what God's done in your life is great. Another barrier for us. We don't have the sensational testimony that is going to wow people. Therefore, they're not really going to get excited about God. Also, a false thought, a false way. God has done something great. Salvation is great. It's a miracle. Anybody that's become a Christian, has been born again into a new life, God's done something amazing for you. If you're not excited about that, it shows. If you are excited about that and you tell others, it shows. Okay. This man, he had pretty much nothing by way of a convincing argument. He just had a story to tell. And Jesus told him, go tell that. And he did. And the people, they were amazed at what God had done, not by this man's clever words. Not by the way he thought and put together an argument. They were amazed by God. There's many stories like this in the Bible. This would be a good template for us to buy into when it comes to sharing our faith. Okay. So that's the man. Let's look at the people's response. Okay, we started talking about this a little bit. They're terrified. They're horrified. Okay, Jesus wrecked their livelihood. 2,000 pigs is probably worth a lot of money. So whoever's pigs those were, it's probably a great loss for them. I don't think insurance was around back then. Okay, maybe UnitedHealthcare, but different industry of insurance. They don't want him to stick around. Oh, yeah. UnitedHealthcare. They don't want him to stick around. He might cause more damage to their world. He might judge more of their disobedience. He might undo their preferred way of life. Now they seem, if I'm guessing right, and it's more than just a guess, but they seem to focus on the things that Jesus is taking away instead of the offer that he's making to them. Jesus is offering them freedom from demonic oppression for sure. He's offering them, you know, a real life lived with God. They seem to be focused on the threat to their existence and the way they've developed their existence, the life that they've now built for themselves and they would prefer to keep. And this is a really, really common rejection of Jesus. It carries on from back then all the way through today. A lot of people reject Jesus for this very reason. My life is exactly what I want it to be. Any threat to that, I'm going to fight against it, including if it's against God himself. They like their lives the way it is. They want to keep what they have. If they let God in, they may have to give up something that they like. Okay. And you will. Guaranteed. This is a very common reason why people reject Jesus. They don't want to give up their life. Now, most of you are probably as into Harry Potter as I am. The uncle of Harry, what's the guy's name? Vernon, the dad, Vernon. What's his biggest complaint with Harry's magic. It's inconvenient to him. His biggest complaint is he's embarrassed by it. It's inconvenient to him. So when Harry stays with his aunt and uncle and cousin during the summer, the reason why his uncle's always on edge is he's got his life established exactly the way he wants. And all of these things that Harry's bringing into his world are nuisances. They're inconvenient. They might damage his reputation. They might undo the life that he's established for himself. It's the same idea. Most people, when they reject Jesus, it's because they don't want to give up their life. The cost is too much. It's too great. They'd have to give up more than they're willing to give up. Maybe you can relate to this. I'm going to just go ahead and say, I know that many of you do relate to this. And the choice that you have to make is a difficult one, and it is one that you should count the cost, because that's what Jesus tells us to do, is count the cost before doing it. But I promise you, it's worth it. There's nothing more important than you knowing the creator of the universe. Nothing you've established in your own life for yourself, no matter how much you like it, is going to outdo a relationship with God. It's more important. It's better. It'll offer you infinitely more than you could ever know. But it takes faith to try it. It's a risk. It takes faith to venture out there and see if it is true or not. I'm here to say it is. I know many of you would also say it is. But if you're not willing to put yourself beyond, if you're not willing to go further out there than what's comfortable, you won't experience the fullness of it in return. We can keep going on this story. There's all sorts of different things we could look at. Jesus is not afraid of this man. How cool is that? This is like the big, enormous professional wrestler that is just going to destroy all opponents, and it's just fear, you know? You're just afraid to step in the ring with this guy. Jesus isn't afraid. He's not afraid of anything. He's not afraid of this guy who's possessed by many, many demons, and nobody else is physically capable to keep him under control. He's not afraid of anything. We can talk about how Jesus can free you from any demon in life, whether it's an actual demon or an addiction or a habit or something that's really got control over your life. Jesus can free anyone from anything. We could come in from a different angle. We could say following Jesus, it doesn't mean we get to do exactly what we were hoping to do. The guy gets freed of the demons, and he wants to go with Jesus, but Jesus tells him no. Get ready to hear that a lot when you follow Jesus. He's not always saying yes to everything that you want to do. In fact, he'll say no to everything that he doesn't want you to do, and yes to the thing he wants you to do. What's the man's response? Awesome. I'm going to do that. We could talk about that if we wanted, but we're not going to. This is really what makes the Bible so amazing. A story like this, you could take it down many, many avenues. There's so much depth to the Bible. There's so much depth to Jesus, his teaching, his ministry, his stories. You can read it, you can reread it, and God's just going to continue to teach you through every time. For now, we're going to keep going, though. All right, so verse 21, we'll read to the end here. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. So he's back on the other side now. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at Jesus' feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her, that she may be made well and alive." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged him about. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus, and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in him that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see that crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, and she fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they had said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him, and he went in to where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and told them to give her something to eat. So everybody's fallen down at Jesus' feet. We saw the demon-possessed man do it. He crosses to the other side. First thing that happens, he steps out of a boat, and a crowd is there wanting to hear him teach, have people healed by him. They're wanting his ministry, basically. Immediately, another man runs up to him. This time, it's not a crazy man. Okay, this time, it's an important man. His name is Jairus. He's the leader of the synagogue. And it says his daughter is sick, and he's asking Jesus to help. And he's completely desperate. He falls down at Jesus' feet, same as the demon-possessed man. Okay, you can imagine his desperation. Jesus immediately starts to follow the man and his company back to his house. Okay? And then the whole crowd starts to follow as well. They're going to go with him. Along the way, a woman sneaks through the crowd. Okay? She's had health issues for 12 years. It says she's had a constant bleeding that no doctors could fix, and she spent all of her money trying to get better. She reaches out, she touches Jesus' robes, and immediately she gets healed. Okay? Jesus stops. He says It says he felt healing power go out from him. She just grabbed his robe, and he said he knew it, that there was healing power that went out from him. He asked, "Who touched me?" And this irritates his disciples. There's a bunch of people around, a whole crowd, and they're saying, how can we figure this one out? The crowd is that many people. Well, the woman, she realizes that she's been found out, so she steps forward. It says, in fear and trembling, she falls down at Jesus' feet. Okay, she falls to the ground, and she tells him the whole story. It says she told him the whole truth. Okay, Jesus speaks to her. He says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace, you are healed." Okay, again, just finishing retelling the story here. After this, a servant comes to them. This is from Jairus' house, the important man. He says, "The daughter has died." Okay? All of them seem to assume that the story's over. Nothing to be done here. They even say, "Don't trouble Jesus anymore. Don't bother the teacher." Okay? Jesus' response, "Do not fear, only believe." From there, he tells the crowd to stay. He doesn't let them come along. He invites Peter, James, and John, his three closest disciples, to come with him. So they go to the man's house with the man and his servants, presumably. So they continue on. They arrive at the house, and there's a bunch of people mourning the daughter's death. Okay, they're out there wailing and crying. They're sad. The young girl has died. And so they're mourning her death. Jesus tells them to be quiet. Okay, this is a repeated phrase. He tells the wind to be quiet. He tells his disciples to be quiet. He tells this crowd to be quiet. He says, she's not dead. She's only asleep. And by the way, the terminology for asleep, the Bible often uses that for people who have died. It's not that she was sleeping. The Bible often says people that have passed away, they're asleep in the Lord, is what it says. So he says, she's not dead. She's only asleep. And it says they all laugh at him. Okay, he's unfazed. He continues on into the house. They go inside. He goes to where the girl is lying, and he speaks to her. Now, it's interesting that we're given the phrase that he says. That's a phrase in Aramaic, talitha kumi. And you wonder, why would we have to have translated that? Well, it's probably because Jesus spoke Greek. Jesus spoke the Greek language. It had, you know, made its way into the area. Greece had ruled over that area for a long time. Most people there spoke Greek and Aramaic. So Jesus speaks this other language, Aramaic, and the writer of the gospel decides it needs to be translated. We need to know what he really said, you know. And it's sort of this endearing term. Little girl, get up. You know, time to wake up is what he's saying. So the girl rises from her bed. She starts walking around, and they're all amazed. He had this 12-year-old girl. She was dead. He brought her back to life. Jesus is the author of life. He has the power to do this. All of us are going to die one day. And you know what? We'll also be resurrected into eternity. That's by Jesus' power. He can do this. He will do this. Question is whether you'll be resurrected to eternal life with God or resurrected to eternity apart from God in hell. But he's the power over life and death. He does this multiple times in his lifetime. He raises his friend Lazarus from the dead. Lazarus, we're not done hanging out yet. Get up. He wakes this girl up from the dead. It'd be easy to read past it and not be amazed by that. It would be super easy if you know the Bible and you read this story, and we're trying to find application in different areas of the story, to just be like, any raise a girl from the dead. Okay, let's go back to talking about us. This is the God that we worship and follow. He's the author of life. He can forgive sin. Okay, he can heal disease. He can stop the weather. Okay, apparently last week the snowstorm was not something he wanted to stop. He didn't want us to have church. Maybe that's it. He didn't stop it then, though. After the girl's up, they say, get her something to eat. Why? Because she was dead and she's hungry. Now, it's sort of a proof that she's not a ghost anymore. Or she's not a ghost now. You know, you watch enough movies and people that die and become spirits in the afterlife, they can't eat. They can't, you know, they're just grasping at the wall. They can't open a door. There's different takes on this, but get that girl something to eat. And he says, don't tell anybody what happened. Remember, all the people outside laughed. They could have been celebrating this with them. He's saying, don't even tell them, you know? So again, another remarkable story here. A lot going on. There's Jairus, there's the woman that snuck up to Jesus and grabbed his robe, and there's the daughter that is raised from the dead. Very briefly, I want to look at the response, sort of the approach, I guess you'd say, that the ruler of the synagogue, Jairus, and this woman took when they came to Jesus. All right, so the ruler of the synagogue, guy's name was Jairus. So he's an important man. He ruled the synagogue, is what it said. Basically, he would be the equivalent of sort of a pastor or an elder in the synagogue. Today in our churches, pastor, elder, probably he owned a business, was wealthy in some way, had servants, but they call him a ruler, and so he's got some authority in the community. He's well thought of. He's an important guy. If you recall, the religious leaders, the important people, they had all started to oppose Jesus. After he started doing miracles, he was doing things that didn't fit into their program, and they had started to look for ways to stop him from doing those things. And so there was various people who started to oppose Jesus, and usually it was the important people, the rulers, the leaders, the religious scribes. Now, I don't know Jairus was one of them or not. We're not really told. On the one hand, Jesus was allowed to teach in the synagogue in Capernaum. This is where Jairus was. Jesus was allowed to teach and heal, and the people were amazed by him. On the other hand, the religious leaders, they all looked for ways to stop Jesus from doing this. He was taking away their people. Whatever authority they had, it looked like nothing compared to him. As they were jealous, they were looking for ways to stop him. Now, I think Jairus was for Jesus. He was in support of him. There's no way to really know for sure whether he had previously opposed him or not. But what we do know is he was in total desperation. Think about it. Your daughter's dying. There's nothing you can do. This is a last-ditch effort. He's so desperate that he leaves the house where his dying daughter is laying to come on this rescue mission. Hopefully he can find Jesus. Hopefully he can get him back to her in time. This is a last-ditch effort. He's that desperate. He's so desperate that he pushes his way through a crowd. Other people wanted Jesus' attention too. He publicly forces himself to the front of the line, gets Jesus' attention. He falls to the ground and pleads with them. How desperate are you when you're pleading for something? Okay, I don't know that I've pleaded my whole life, to be honest. I've seen others. I've watched others. I've heard of others. I can't think of a time where I've really pleaded, you know? But you'd have to want something awful bad to get to that place. This is the way to approach Jesus. Completely desperate and yet fully confident. People who are important have a really hard time with that. Being completely desperate and at the same time totally confident in Jesus. Usually they don't have a need. If you are an important person, if you think yourself to be an important person, you don't have a felt need that you're approaching God about. You've got things under control. You're well thought of. There's more or less your life is what you want it to be. Other people would affirm that for you. You're important enough. Most of the time, there's not really a need. And also, the confidence they would have would be in themselves. I've arrived here for a reason. Hard work, smarts, and all the rest. Most important people have a hard time approaching God. It's hard to humble themselves. This man was in total desperation, humbled himself, was willing to do anything. Okay, now, you don't have to be important or wealthy to have this as a problem. Human beings, humankind, is born into this way of thinking. We all think ourselves to be self-important. You know, you may not think of yourself as the most important. You may see others as better than you, but most of us would at least hold ourselves to a level of importance that would prevent us from opening ourselves up to God. We would think we know enough. We'd think we're smart enough. We'd think, that can't be right. I know better. Okay, that's self-importance. But you do need to overcome this if you're going to approach Jesus. This is the way to approach him. Completely desperate and yet fully confident. Okay, lastly here, the bleeding woman. Okay, now she's an Israelite. Her bleeding had a serious negative effect on her life. This is more than just a physical malady. This is more than just an illness and a disease that caused her physical suffering. Under the Jewish law, she would have been considered spiritually unclean for this entire time. Anytime a person touched blood at all, they're considered unclean. You know what the requirement was? They had to walk down the street, maintain separation from everybody else, and announce that they're unclean to the people passing by. This would have made her an outcast. This would have made her completely alone. She would not have been able to go in the temple and worship God. She probably wasn't even allowed in the synagogue to worship God. Worse yet, her uncleanness was considered transmittable to other people. Now, not that she would necessarily, we don't know what her disease was, but that it would pass to other people. This is more the spiritual uncleanness. So if she touched another person, they themselves would also be considered unclean. This is by the Jewish ceremonial law. Okay, so she couldn't touch people is what the point is. She wouldn't have been able to be a mother that could hold her children, a wife, that could embrace her husband, an aunt, a sister, a friend. This would have made this woman an outcast in her own home. Think about that. 12 years with no personal touch of anybody. Or every time there is, you've done something wrong. Imagine what this woman's state of mind and this state of emotional spirit would have been in at this time. She would have been completely alone. Now, it said apparently the doctors weren't able to heal her. She spent all of her money trying to get this fixed, and it didn't work. She, too, was completely desperate, just like Jairus, just like the synagogue ruler. Similar to him, she pushes through the crowd to get to Jesus. In doing this, she takes a big risk. Okay, what if she offends Jesus? What if by breaking the religious rules of the day, that offended him to a way he wouldn't help her? What if when she touched him, he became unclean and it ruined it for everybody else? This is a big risk, isn't it? What about the others she touched in the crowd? They probably knew her. They were probably used to her operating on the fringe, not being in the mix. Her approach, this tells us something about faith. Faith is bold. It has to be. Faith risks everything. Faith insists. It says, I'm not going to be denied. I believe this is true. I'm going to stand on it. I'm not going to change my mind. Faith is humble. Okay, it doesn't seek to be seen or recognized. This woman doesn't try to be, you know, healed up on stage in front of everybody. She tries not to be noticed. Faith is humble. Faith is honest. She doesn't hide any details from Jesus. It says she tells him the whole story. He already knew, by the way. He knew who she was and what she was suffering. He knew, but she was honest with him, and so she's honest with herself. Look, the Bible says it's impossible to please God without faith. This is Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. And without faith is it impossible to please God, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Doesn't matter if you're important. Doesn't matter if you're an outcast. Each person needs to approach Jesus with this same sincere need. Okay, we all have the same need. We're all created in God's image, and yet we're apart from God due to our own sin. And that needs to be reconciled. Everybody has that exact same need. When we approach God, when we look to him, it has to be from a place of desperation, of need. Okay? Whether we're Jairus or whether we're this woman, the approach isn't all that different. Getting there is a whole lot different. If you think of yourself as an important person, it'll be a lot harder to humble yourself down to a place of need. If you're somebody that's in need, it's not as hard. But you got to get there. If you don't think you have a need, you're not there. If you don't have some sort of desperation where, God, I need you to help me, you're not there. You need to know that you're broken. You need to seek out Jesus. And you need to trust him to put you back together. That's how you approach Jesus. Let's pray.